Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you are having a good day whenever you are listening to this. And today's episode is going to kind of piggyback off of my last episode, which if you have not listened to episode 295, then go listen to that first.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to ruin it right now. So this is your warning. Go listen to episode 295 if you haven't yet. And now I'm going to ruin it. So I am sorry again for playing an April Fool's prank and pretending that the Russian sleep experiment was real.
Comments.
But I think a lot of people.
Oh my God. We got the funniest comments. I was like, clearly y'all didn't listen. Because I was like, we know. Like it's not real, but it's still funny.
Yeah, we know it's not real. I posted the story on TikTok and I did it in like two parts and so many people in part one were like, this is just a creepypasta. Like, I can't believe you think this is a real story. And I'm like, dude,
I thought you were better than this. I was like, girl, yeah, like, it's not that serious.
So exactly. But,
and my reactions were real. Cause we got some questions about me being in on it. I was not in on it. I was completely reacting organically, authentically, and I was just
I can literally post a screenshot of our texts of me being like, do you know anything? And Andrea saying no. But it was fun and I think a lot of people liked it.
Yeah.
And I had mentioned in that episode that it kind of reminded me of the Stanford Prison Experiment, which if you've taken a psychology course, you have likely heard of the Stanford Prison Experiment. It's very widely taught, although it is now kind of debunked slash not included in as many textbooks, insight courses and stuff, but we'll talk all about that. But I wanted to do an episode on it because I think it's really interesting. And I know this is a little bit different and not really like technically true crime, I guess, but it is kind of like related. And I think a lot of us that listen to true crime like the psychology of things. And so I was on a road trip and deep dove. I don't know what the right phrase is, but I went deep into this and I found it super fascinating. Maybe that's because I studied psychology, but like,
yeah, I think that's why most of us are here. I mean, I know there's definitely people who like don't have interests in psychology that like true crime, but I feel like that's the backing for a lot of it.
I think so too. So today we are going to consider what happens when you put good people in an evil place and if humanity wins over evil or if evil triumphs. Because that's exactly what the researchers who conducted the 1971 Stanford Prison Experiment wanted to find out. I want to say that they're like I kind of mentioned, have been many studies kind of debunking the results of the experiment due to its methodology and several other factors. We will be discussing all of that. We'll discuss kind of what went wrong, the criticisms, the ethical concerns, and why many say the study should not be shared in psychology textbooks anymore. But first, we're going to go through what the experiment was, how it took place, and everything behind it.
Yeah.
So the Stanford Prison Experiment was a psychological experiment conducted in August 1971 at Stanford University, led by psychology professor Philip Zimbardo. And let me just say, I will post a picture of him because he looks like the epitome of like what you would think a psychologist in the 70s would look like. It is so funny. But the goal of this experiment for Zimbardo was to see the differing psychological effects of becoming a prisoner or a prison guard, and to investigate the psychological effects of perceived power. From a 1996 Stanford News Service article about the experiment, quote, Zimbardo's primary reason for conducting the experiment was to focus on the power of roles, rules, symbols, group identity, and situational validation of behavior that generally would repulse ordinary individuals.
Hmm.
Zimbardo told the Toronto Symposium in 1996, quote, I had been conducting research for some years on de-individuation, vandalism, and dehumanization that illustrated the ease with which ordinary people could be led to engage in antisocial acts by putting them in situations where they felt anonymous, or they could perceive of others in a way that made them feel less human, as enemies or objects.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like just based on like how social media is and how ballsy people are on social media, because they know that in a way they are quote unquote anonymous, or they are who they are, but the chances you'll ever be face to face with that person gives you that sense of anonymity.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's such a good point.
Hi, my name is Andrea and I went to school for psychology.
She's like being facetious.
Yes.
Not like actually, but I actually saying did. That I for did. Anybody. But she did. Yeah.
Yeah.
She does have a psychology degree.
My bachelor's of science in psychology. Yes. But yeah.
But that's so interesting. I never thought about it like that.
Like modern day that theory.
Yeah. It's the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Oh, so Zimbardo set out to understand this phenomenon with a research team at Stanford. And I didn't know this, but the study was actually funded by the U.S. Office of Naval Research, because the Navy and Marine Corps wanted to understand the conflict between military guards and prisoners and how antisocial behavior plays into those dynamics.
Okay.
So they agreed to fund this study so that they could like hopefully get something out of it.
Interesting. Okay.
To recruit participants for the study, an ad was placed in the Help Wanted section of the Palo Alto Times and the Stanford Daily. And the ad read, male college students needed for psychological study of prison life. $15 per day for 1 to 2 weeks beginning August 14th. For further information and applications, come to room 248, Jordan Hall, Stanford U. And just to put that into more context, $15 in 1971 is equal to about $115 today in 2024. So All right. The ad was offering in today's money about $115 a day to participate in this 2-week experiment.
Which for someone who maybe doesn't have a job or is in between jobs or needs a second job
and
is very
like
enticing.
College students,
oh, yeah.
Like, and this wasn't just two college students, but a right. lot of people in the area were college students. And so that's a lot of money for a college student.
Hell yeah.
And I think a lot of the men, too, kind of thought like, oh, this will be time for us to go and study or relax, which obviously right. ended up not being that, but that was probably what some of them thought.
Yeah.
So over 70 men applied for the experiment, and they were each given diagnostic interviews and personality tests. And the goal of this was to eliminate any candidates with psychological problems, medical disabilities, or a history of crime or drug abuse. After all of these tests, there were 24 participants that remained. And these were all college-aged men from the U.S. and Canada. They were all educated, middle class, and they were mostly white. There was one Asian-American man, but the rest were white men.
Interesting. I would think they would want a broader, like, what's the word? I don't know the word. I can't
sample.
Think of the... Yeah, there we go. That works.
Yeah, so they did probably, but that's not what they ended up with. Okay. You know, it was the 1970s, but
true.
That does not accurately represent the population,
no.
especially not in a prison, which is kind of what this was meant to simulate and apply findings to. So
okay.
That's something that was a little not so great that
missed.
We'll talk more about later.
Okay.
But the official SPE website says, quote, on all dimensions that we were able to test or observe, they reacted normally. So this just means like by all accounts, they were like, quote unquote, normal, whatever.
They passed all their tests, whether they were actually normal or good at behaving and portraying normal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So on August 14th, 1971, the mock prison was set up with the help of a former inmate. This man spent 17 years in prison at San Quentin, and he helped kind of, he was like their prison consultant to like talk about what actual prison was like.
Okay.
And I'm not going to share his name. It's very widely shared and you can find it, but he has since said that he like regrets being a part of this experiment. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not going to say his name. It's not important. Just know that there was a prison consultant. And if you really want to find out, you can Google search it.
Okay.
In the basement of Stanford Psychology Building, Jordan Hall, a 35-foot section was cordoned off for the experiment for the jail. The cells were several lab rooms where the doors were removed and makeshift jail doors were put on. And these were about 7 by 10 feet rooms. And each room had 3 cots inside for 3 prisoners. And the cots just had a mattress, a sheet, and a pillow. The cells were unlit and kind of just like dry and drab. There weren't windows. There wasn't really a lot going on.
Okay.
The corridor outside was what the prison yard was, but they were only allowed out there for yard time and to eat. The bathroom was outside of that, but every time they were taken to the bathroom, they were blindfolded so that they couldn't see like how to get out of the prison. Because of course, this isn't like an actual prison. So they could get out. There was also a closet for solitary confinement, which they called the hole. And this was, quote, dark and very confining, about 2 feet wide and 2 feet deep, but tall enough that a bad prisoner could stand up.
Mm.
Next to this prison was also an area for the guards for kind of their like rest area. This was a more well-lit, comfortable, bigger area. So in very much a contrast to where the prisoners would be kept.
Right.
There was a camera facing inside so that everything that happened could be watched. And there were also intercoms in the prison cells that allowed the researchers to secretly hear what was being said inside the cells and to allow them to make announcements. On top of the lack of windows, there were also no clocks so that the prisoners wouldn't know what time or day it was, further taking away their autonomy.
Yeah, that's a mind-boggling feeling.
Mm-hmm. Zimbardo acted as the superintendent of the prison, and his undergraduate research assistant, David Jaffe, became the warden. The participants were arbitrarily split into groups of prisoners and guards by the flip of a coin. On August 14th, Zimbardo and his researchers held an orientation for those who they assigned to be guards. The instructions to the guards included that they were to maintain law and order, but were to not harm the prisoners physically or withhold food and drink. But other than that, they were basically given no instruction on how to act as guards because they wanted them to make up their own set of rules to figure out how they were going to control the prisoners. They didn't want to sway them by saying, like, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do. They wanted to see how they were going to react when put in a position of power.
But they were told not to use physical violence.
Correct. And to not withhold food and drink.
Okay.
To distinguish the guards from the prisoners, the guards wore khaki shirts and pants from a local military surplus store, and they also wore mirrored sunglasses so that the prisoners could not see their emotions.
Interesting. Okay.
According to Zimbardo, quote, mirror sunglasses prevented anyone from seeing their eyes or reading their emotions and thus helped to further promote their anonymity. We were, of course, studying not only the prisoners, but also the guards who found themselves in a new power-laden role. The guards were also instructed to refer to the prisoners by number instead of name, and this was intended to diminish the prisoners' individuality. The guards were to work in 8-hour shifts of 3 guards each, and when they were off duty, they were encouraged to leave the prison. So in contrast to the prisoners who had to stay there for the entirety of the experiment, these guards were allowed to like leave, live their life outside of their little shifts.
Interesting.
So very different.
Yeah, that's I don't know if I would like that if I was picked to be a prisoner. I'd be like, wait a minute. Seems a little unfair.
I know. And Zimbardo later claimed that people at the start of the experiment, probably before they knew about any of this, what was going to happen, wanted to be prisoners, which I don't know how true that is, but
yeah.
It, like you said, it is not really fair, and they're kind of like making more money in a way because they're kind of working less, like quote unquote working.
True.
Because they're only there for like 8 hours at a time.
Right.
But either way, on August 15th, the experiment officially began. There were 9 guards and 9 prisoners, and then 3 guards and 3 prisoners that were basically like on call in case somebody needed to sub in. So the experiment began, and the men who were assigned the role of prisoners were fake arrested by the Palo Alto Police Department.
What?
So the Palo Alto Police Department literally went and arrested them. Some of this happening in front of these people's like parents, like real or lives. Like, friends. And they did not know that this was going to happen. The researchers wanted them to really feel like they were prisoners.
Yeah.
And so this was a complete surprise. And of course they, I'm sure, like figured out that that's what was happening.
Yeah.
But this was not expected to them. And a lot of people say that this was a breach of ethics from the contract that the participants signed. But it was later revealed that the contract basically just said, we agree to participate and we agree that we have been informed of what this experiment is about. So we don't know what they were told, and they signed it. So technically, probably, like, you know, it's not really a breach.
Yeah.
But it's more of like an ethical question.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if they were like really rough with them and like, you know, throwing them around and really treating them poorly. But also I feel like it's kind of part, it would kind of feel like part of the experiment too. Like,
yeah, it was kind of, yeah, that's exactly what it was. So they were arrested for violating penal codes 211 and 459, which are robbery and burglary. And they were brought to the police department and actually booked like actual prisoners. They were fingerprinted, their mugshots were taken, and they were put in holding cells.
Wow.
They were then blindfolded and transported to the prison in Jordan Hall. And once they were there, they were strip searched. They were assigned their numbers, and they were given a uniform to wear.
Strip search. Wow.
Yeah. This uniform was basically a smock. They were given no underwear. The smocks were ill-fitting. Mm. And the intention of this was, you know, Zimbardo would say in real prisons, they don't wear smocks, but this was just another way of taking away their individuality and kind of like imitating
them, bare their dignity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
They obviously like couldn't imitate every single aspect of a prison. So some things they had to kind of do other things to make that same feeling of like, you're no longer the person, you are the inmate.
Yeah. And I get that, but I also feel like you're not going to get like a thorough result because you're not like in a actual jail. They'll have like a jumpsuit or like the scrubs or whatever. And I feel like that's way more demeaning to put them in a like a hospital gown, essentially.
Yeah. And smock. That's some of the controversy about
it. Yeah. I feel like that's, you're trying to like make them feel the smallest they can feel.
Yeah. They were. Their uniforms had their prison number sewn on them, and they also wore a chain around one ankle, which again, this does not happen in prisons.
No.
Like, you know, if you're being transported or something, maybe, but like when you're just in the prison, you're not chained up. Mm-hmm. But again, it was a way for them to simulate the prison environment without having an actual prison environment, according to Zimbardo. Another way they did this was to put a nylon stocking over their heads to simulate having their heads shaved. Because in most prisons, prisoners' heads are shaved, again, to kind of take away their individuality.
Yeah.
But they weren't going to shave their heads, which is just like wild to me that all the other stuff that you'll see they did.
But no, we're not going to shave their heads.
Yeah. But That's how they simulated that. And the goal of all of this was to disorient, depersonalize, and de-individuate the prisoners. Day two started at 2:30 a.m. when the guards woke the prisoners up for a count. They were awoken by whistles and the clanging of batons. And at this point, the prisoners kind of already started rebelling, but more in like a fun way, more in like a like, oh, we're going to rebel because this is like a funny experiment.
Yeah.
But they started refusing to leave their cells to eat in the yard. They were ripping off their inmate number tags and started insulting the guards. Mm-hmm. By the time a new shift of guards came in later that morning, they were visibly frustrated at the night guards who, quote, they felt must have been too lenient. So already this weird dynamic between the guards is happening.
So not just against prisoner and guards, like against the other guards too.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I just want to veg out on my phone and play a fun game. Recently, I discovered June's Journey, which is a hidden object mystery game, and I am obsessed. I am 3 chapters in, and I cannot put it down.
I've been loving it too, because not only does it bring out my inner detective, but eventually I'll be able to uncover the mystery behind the case. You play the game as June Parker, a young woman in the 1920s trying to solve her own sister's murder. And the clues that you start finding all point to June's family having some deep, dark secrets.
During the game, you get to create your own estate, which appeals to my inner interior designer. But before we ruin too much for you guys, you have to download June's Journey for yourself. It's free today on iOS and Android devices.
Check out the link to download June's Journey in the show notes of this episode. So these new morning guards called in 3 backup guards, and then the night shift guards also voluntarily stayed to help control this riot that was outbreaking. And this was when they kind of started to use some methods of physical control. Mm. While they didn't physically hit anybody, they started spraying fire extinguishers at them. They removed their clothes so that they were naked.
Jeez.
They also took away their mattresses and pillows. And they sentenced the biggest instigators of the riot to time in the hole, aka solitary confinement, in that closet.
Wow.
One of the biggest physical punishments used throughout the experiment was forcing prisoners to do push-ups, sometimes with the weight of the guard's boot on their back.
Oof.
Yeah. So it's kind of teetering on that line of like, they're not, you know, physically like
roughing them up necessarily, but definitely pushing the boundaries.
Yeah. Throughout the rest of day two, the guards also used psychological manipulation to control the prisoners. They went further the next day by separating the quote-unquote good prisoners who had smaller parts in the rebellion from the bad prisoners that were more of the instigators. Basically, what they did was they put the good prisoners in one cell where they were given their clothes, their beds, all of that. And then everyone else was left naked, not given their mattresses, and also denied food, which was directly going against Zimbardo's rules.
Wow. And now they're causing a divide with the prisoners, which is going to naturally make them jealous of each other and conflict.
Exactly. And they made this worse by basically... Hold on, I just lost my train of thought. They made this divide worse by separating them and then letting the quote-unquote good prisoners, or not letting, forcing the good prisoners to eat their food in front of the bad prisoners.
Yeah. Damn. They wasted no time to break the rules, did they?
No, it went real fast, but nothing changed. Zimbardo, the research assistants, didn't step in, didn't, you know, say, hey, you can't do that. That's against the rules. And the experiment continued.
Almost feels like they probably knew that was going to happen. And they were Maybe even encouraging it a little bit by bringing it up.
Mm-hmm. And we might talk a little bit more about that.
Okay.
Another thing that guards did was restrict access to bathrooms and force the prisoners to relieve themselves in a bucket in their cells and then not empty that bucket so that it would start to overflow. On day 3, August 17th, the first prisoner left the experiment. Douglas Corpy, who was identified as prisoner 8612, began to kind of have a mental breakdown after 36 hours in jail.
Damn.
From the SPE website, quote, when our primary prison consultant interviewed prisoner number 8612, the consultant chided him for being so weak and told him what kind of abuse he could expect from the guards and the prisoners if he were in San Quentin, which is an actual prison, right, if you didn't know. Number 8612 was then given the offer of becoming an informant in exchange for no further guard harassment. He was told to think it over. During the next count, he told other prisoners, "You can't leave. You can't quit." That sent a chilling message and heightened their sense of really being imprisoned. Number 8612 then began to act crazy, to scream, to curse, to go into a rage that seemed out of control. It took quite a while before we became convinced that he was really suffering and that we had to release him.
Well, that's good at least.
Yeah. But he was basically like getting to a point where he was yelling things like, "Jesus Christ, I'm burning up inside," and "I can't stand another night. I just can't take it anymore." And at first they thought that he was just doing this to try to get out of it. Right. But as he kept going, they realized maybe we should let him go. So research assistant Craig Haney finally decided to release Corpy.
That's so interesting because it seems kind of quick in the experiment. So I wonder if he just like maybe was one of the ones that got by when he already had like maybe some emotional or mental health issues.
He might have. So he actually spoke out in 2017 about his experience. And in this interview, he claimed that breakdown was fake. Oh. He said that he needed to get back to studying for his graduate record exam, his GRE. And he claimed that he initially believed he'd be able to study while like participating in this experiment, but that the guards didn't allow him to study and he needed to get out. So he faked the breakdown so he would be released.
Okay. Well,
now, yeah. After this, Zimbardo came out and said he believes what Corpy said in 2017 was a lie because he claimed that in 1992, in a documentary about the city called Quiet Rage, Corpy said that the SPE had deeply affected him and that the experience itself had led him to become a prison psychologist. But like it could have deeply affected him and he still could have faked that breakdown.
Yeah. Like just being in the experiment could have pushed him to that career path.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's unclear exactly what happened with Corpy, but
I don't know.
Yeah. Either way, he was released and the experiment continued on. By day 4, the prisoners really started to realize that the guards were continuing to separate them into these good and bad groups. And this was when they kind of started turning against each other, which is like what you had mentioned.
Right.
They then started mixing them back up. And the bad prisoners started believing that the good prisoners were snitches and vice versa. The good prisoners saw the rioters and, you know, the bad prisoners as a threat because they disrupted the status quo of the prison. From the SPE website, quote, "The prisoners' rebellion also played an important role in producing greater solidarity among the guards. Now, suddenly, it was no longer just an experiment, no longer a simple simulation. Instead, the guards saw the prisoners as troublemakers who were out to get them, who might really cause them some harm. In response to this threat, the guards began stepping up their control, surveillance, and aggression."
So everybody's just going to keep escalating, mm-hmm. escalating.
Exactly.
No bueno.
Another prisoner whose name has never been released, just his fake inmate number, prisoner number 819, was actually released on day 4. Now, this prisoner was starting to show symptoms of distress. They had actually brought a priest in, a real priest, to speak to the prisoners as if it was like an actual prison.
Okay.
But the Prisoner 819 declined to speak to the priest and asked for a medical doctor, saying that he needed medical attention. Zimbardo decided to move him to another room to rest, but he could hear what the guards were doing with the other prisoners, which was forcing them to chant, "Prisoner 819 is a bad prisoner.
No.
Because of what Prisoner 819 did, my cell is a mess."
Oh my gosh.
And they were forcing them to repeat this over and over and over. And when Zimbardo went into that room to check on Prisoner 819, he was sobbing uncontrollably, according to Zimbardo. And Zimbardo said, quote, "I suggest we leave," but he refused. Through his tears, he said he could not leave because the others had labeled him a bad prisoner. Even though he was feeling sick, he wanted to go back and prove he was not a bad prisoner. "At that point, I said, listen, you are not number 819. You are his name. And my name is Dr. Zimbardo. I'm a psychologist, not a prison superintendent, and this is not a real prison. This is just an experiment, and those are students, not prisoners, just like you." Zimbardo said he then stopped crying and, quote, "looked up at me like a small child awakening from a nightmare," and replied, "okay, let's go."
Wow. So he had like a mental break, like out of touch with reality completely.
Wow. Whew. So now we're on to day 5, which was visitation day. For this, each prisoner was allowed 2 visitors that could visit for 10 minutes while being supervised by a guard. Now, the guards and Zimbardo, well, Zimbardo was afraid that these visitors would come in and see what was happening and, like, cause an uproar.
Right.
So to prevent this, they basically manipulated it to look like the prisoners were in better states than they were. They groomed and shaved them. They forced the prisoners to clean their cells, and they fed them a good meal, pumped music in throughout the prison, and basically tried to lift everybody's spirits. But when the visitors did see them, many became concerned. Most of these visitors were parents, and some left with concerns about their son's well-being, if they were eating enough, and planning to contact lawyers to get their children, quote-unquote, released.
Wow.
Right? Day 5 also saw escalating abuse by the guards because they were starting to use more physical violence against the prisoners. They were forcing them to wear bags over their heads, and they also started assaulting them with their batons.
What in the world? Like, this is an experiment. Like, what are you doing?
And that this was exactly what Zimbardo was hoping for, that they kind of got to this point where they were really, like, embracing their roles, even though it was just an experiment.
Yeah.
They were continuing to deny the prisoners access to bathrooms, food, and water, but Zimbardo wasn't stopping any of it.
Jeez.
On the night of August 19th, which was day 5, Christina Maslach, a social psychologist who is a professor at Berkeley, visited the prison. And she was appalled at what she saw. She, quote, challenged Zimbardo about his lack of caring oversight and the immorality of the study. She also expressed to him how his role of superintendent had turned him into something she did not recognize, and she challenged him about the ethical implications of the experiment.
Wow.
And we will talk about Zimbardo and his role in the as the superintendent in a little bit.
So it was taking effect on him as well. Dang.
It really was.
Weird.
But Christina coming in and saying this to Zimbardo is in large part why Zimbardo decided to end the Stanford prison experiment the next day.
Oh, okay.
He was also getting increasing concerns from participants, and he started to worry about the behavior of the guards. And so he, on day 6, gathered all the participants and researchers and told them that the experiment was over. He paid them for their time and began debriefing with them. And they each spoke with Zimbardo, and then they also spoke as a group about the experiment. And then they were asked to complete a personal retrospective and mail it in. And then a week after the experiment, they reconvened to share their thoughts again.
It's so
with that,
crazy, sorry, that he's just going to release these people back into the wild.
I know.
Like, I remember learning about this in school, but I don't remember the details. I just remember, like, the extreme nature, like the context of that.
I know, same.
But I couldn't remember like all the details. So I don't really remember what happens, but I do kind of feel like something else happens.
It kind of, it's more just like the implications of it and like really what went wrong and why.
Yeah.
It maybe shouldn't come to the conclusions that it came to. Because I'm the same. Like before I did all this research, I remembered learning about it in school, but I haven't taken like a basic psychology course since my sophomore, I think, year of high school.
Yeah.
And so it's been a long time since I like actually learned about this. And I do remember, like you said, like the extreme nature of it.
Yeah.
But, and I remember my sophomore psychology teacher, who was awesome, by the way, and like got me interested in psychology. Shout out to Mr. Wheeler. He was supposed to be my officiant at my wedding, but got COVID before and couldn't.
I remember that.
Yeah. But I remember him talking about this experiment and kind of being like, it's, you know, not all great. That it's chocolate to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this experiment that was supposed to last up to 2 weeks ended up being shut down after 6 days. So with that, let's talk about what came from the experiment. We'll first discuss Zimbardo's interpretation of the results, and then we'll go through what has been done in the subsequent years and the ethical concerns. So, first of all, Zimbardo admits that he got into the role of superintendent, and he said that he really saw this when he heard about an escape plan that was hatched by the prisoners.
Oh, no.
So I'm going to read this part directly from the SPE website because I think it's interesting to hear it from Zimbardo's perspective. So just stick with me. It's like a little bit long, of a long quote, but I think it's really interesting to hear it from what he said about it and not like just me paraphrasing it.
Okay.
So he said, the next major event we had to contend was a rumored mass escape plot. One of the guards overheard the prisoners talking about an escape that would take place immediately after visiting hours. The rumor went as follows. Prisoner number 8612, whom we had released the night before, was going to round up a bunch of his friends and break in to free the prisoners. How do you think we reacted to this rumor? Do you think we recorded the pattern of rumor transmission and prepared to observe the impending escape? That was what we should have done, of course, if we were acting like experimental social psychologists. Mm. So already in his like reflection of this, he's like, this was where I realized. Yeah.
Interesting.
Instead, we reacted with concern over the security of our prison. What we did was to hold a strategy session with the warden, the superintendent, and one of our chief lieutenants, which was another one of the research assistants, to plan how to foil the escape. After our meeting, we decided to put an informant in the cell that number 8612 had occupied. So this was one of those extra prisoner participants that weren't brought in originally.
Right.
The job of our informant would be to give us information about the escape plot. Then I went back to the Palo Alto Police Department and asked the sergeant if we could have our prisoners transferred to their old jail cell.
What?
My request was turned down because the police department would not be covered by insurance if we moved our prisoners into their jail.
Yeah.
I left angry and disgusted at this lack of cooperation between our correctional facilities. I was now totally into my role.
What?
So just taking a little break here. Isn't that crazy how he literally went? Yeah. He went to the police department. So he himself was getting into this.
Bro, that's crazy. This is like 6 days. We're not like 30 days in or, you know.
Right?
Not even 6 days because he went before the experiment was over at 6 days. So 3-4 days in.
I think this was like
and he's already losing his marbles.
Yeah.
And you're a psychiatrist or psychologist, researcher, all of the above. Wow.
Yeah, all of the above. So basically after this, he said they formulated another plan to dismantle the jail, chain the prisoners together, put bags over their heads, and transport them to another storage room in the psychology building. Mm. So he was full on planning this other thing where they were going to bring all the prisoners up. But before he could, He said, quote, I was sitting there all alone, waiting anxiously for the intruders to break in, when who should happen along but a colleague and former Yale graduate student roommate, Gordon Bauer. Now, remember, this is in the basement of the psychology building where all of these other professors' offices are.
Yeah.
And it's summertime, so they're not there, but they still, like, can come to the building. Yeah. So Gordon Bauer came and was like, hey, what's going on
here? What are you doing, dude? Why are you
being a weirdo? And so Zimbardo said, I briefly described what we were up to, and Gordon asked me a very simple question. Say, what's the independent variable in this study? To my surprise, I got really angry at him. Here, I had a prison break on my hands. The security of my men and the stability of my prison was at stake. And now I had to deal with this bleeding heart academic ding dong who was concerned about the independent variable. It wasn't until much later that I realized how far into my prison role I was at that point. That I was thinking like a prison superintendent rather than a research psychologist.
He was wrapped up in the delusion. He was like,
yeah,
like a burrito in that motherfucker.
Yeah. So this was another thing, I think, when his colleague came.
That's good, though. He brought him back to reality.
Yeah. And kind of snapped him out of it. And then Christina came and there were more concerns. This was kind of all what led up to him ending the experiment. So Zimbardo's conclusions at the end of the experiment were that the prisoners were disintegrated both as a group and as individuals. They were no longer any group of unity, just a bunch of isolated individuals hanging on, much like prisoners of war or hospitalized mental patients. The guards, in contrast, had won total control of the prison, and they commanded the blind obedience of each prisoner. Zimbardo noted how the guards had very little instruction, yet they began humiliating and abusing the prisoners like real prison guards.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the prisoners, while they were not actual prisoners, were submissive and took the abuse with little protest, fully embracing their role of a prisoner.
It's like they fell right into like the stereotypes of both of those things, like without hesitation, exactly. Which is wild.
Yeah, it is. But his largest conclusion is that the prison controlled the individual's behavior. He said social situations hold a significant amount of power over how individuals will act in those situations. Mm-hmm. He posited that good people can turn evil if the environment is right. Yeah. He said, quote, good people can be transformed into perpetrators of evil, and healthy people can begin to experience pathological reactions traceable to situational forces.
I agree.
From Simple Psychology, quote, the results of the Stanford Prison Experiment showed that situational factors and power dynamics played a significant role in shaping participants' behavior. The guards became abusive and authoritarian, while the prisoners became submissive and emotionally distressed. However, this conclusion has been widely criticized for being overgeneralized. This is because, while yes, the environment and the situation can influence behavior, that is not the only thing, and not basically the biggest issue here, to put it in like super layman's terms, is that Zimbardo said any good person can turn evil if put in the right situation. And critics of this say, well, no, that's not necessarily true. While it may, situations might impact you, not every single good person can be turned evil just by a situation. That is a very generalized high level explanation of it. So now we're going to dive into some of the criticisms of the Stanford Prison Experiment and why the conclusions drawn by Zimbardo may not be as accurate as once believed. Now, first of all, a very important part of scientific experimentation is producing the same results by experiments after the original one. And the SPE is practically impossible to reproduce. In 2002, two psychologists conducted what came to be known as the BBC Prison Study to, quote, examine Zimbardo's themes of tyranny and resistance. So this was similar to the SPE in many ways, but there were some differences, including that there was a lot closer recording of the participants during the experiment, and it was originally advertised as a university-backed social science experiment to be shown on TV in a reality show. There were also differences during the actual experiment, including that prisoners were told that they could be promoted to guards, leading to more individualization and less group identification, as well as less resistance and fight back. The findings of the BBC prison study were that individual traits have more of an effect on behavior than the environment does. This study questions the notion that people slip mindlessly into their roles, as was concluded by the SPE. So, two parts of this. One part is that it is pretty much impossible to replicate and get right. the same results. Therefore, a lot of people say, I just hit my microphone, sorry, but a lot of people say it's like not a proper scientific study. And then the other part of it is that when a similar thing was replicated, there were different results, but there were also different instructions. So this kind of shows you,
Can't compare it.
And it also kind of shows you like how the experiment, what is said about it, can impact what is done. There's also been a lot of discussion about the methodology of the study itself. So, of course, we talked about how the sample was not very diverse at all. There's also arguments that selection bias may have played a role. Selection bias is the bias introduced by the selection of individuals, groups, or data for analysis in such a way that proper randomization is not achieved, thereby failing to ensure the sample that the sample obtained is representative of the population intended to be analyzed. So some argue that in the SPE, because the ad described the need for a psychological, the need for participants in a psychological study of prison life, it may have influenced the people who applied, because people are seeing this and saying, oh, of prison life, that's interesting. And maybe people who are applying are more likely to kind of be, what's the word I'm looking for? Like kind of in that like social dominance.
Like less likely to actually be arrested and sent to prison.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say is like someone who might be, you know, either a former criminal or an active criminal or, you know, in that realm, whether it be like, a you know, family, friends, whatever, like they are going to, they're not going to want to apply. They're going to stay away from that because that's scary to them. They know what happens, you know?
Yeah.
And someone else who's never experienced it is going to be like, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me give that a try.
Yeah, that's a very good point. In 2007, two psychologists tested exactly that. So Thomas Carnahan and Sam McFarland questioned whether that the use of the words prison life in the ad influenced who applied. So they created a study where they recreated that original ad and then also created a second ad omitting the phrase prison life.
Ah, very smart.
They found, quote, that the people who responded to the two ads scored differently on a set of psychological tests. Those who thought that they would be participating in a prison study had significantly higher levels of aggressiveness, authoritarianism, narcissism, and social dominance, and they scored lower on measures of empathy and altruism.
That's not good for a prison experiment.
No. And so that's why a lot of people say that, you know, Zimbardo's experiment wasn't really, Yeah. And there, you know, there's no good way to test this and get a proper sample. It's just not something that can really be done.
Not. Yeah.
It has also been noted that Zimbardo's research assistant, David Jaffe, the one who was the warden, reportedly can be heard encouraging guards to use more force or to be stronger when he thought they were being too lenient.
So he's influencing them after they were told not to do that.
Exactly.
Hmm.
They also, as we mentioned, didn't stop or chastise the guards for exerting physical abuse, which was supposed to be avoided. Right. In 2018, Zimbardo said about this, quote, "The SPE was designed as a mock prison simulating some of the main features that characterized the American prison system at that time. Central in the training of guards was to exercise their power over the prisoners so that they maintained order, prevented rebellion, and eliminated escape attempts. My instruction to the guards, as documented by recordings of the guard orientation, were that they could not hit prisoners, but could create feelings of boredom, frustration, fear, and a sense of powerlessness. We did not give any formal or detailed instructions about how to be an effective guard." So he's basically saying, like, we're doing less than what's actually happening in prisons. This is what's actually happening in prisons, but we didn't tell them to do that, which is fine. But then you can't come to conclusions about the guards and say they came to this because right. of their situation. Like, it could have been many factors.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And again, the use of force was never stopped.
Right. So you're basically showing them that meant nothing. It was a fake threat.
Exactly. Now, one of the participants who played a guard, a man named David Eshelman, would later recall that he, quote, consciously created his guard persona. So he said, "I was in all kinds of drama productions in high school and college. It was something I was very, very familiar with, to take on another personality before you step out on the stage. I was kind of running my own experiment in there by saying, how far can I push these things and how much abuse will these people take before they say, knock it off?" So he basically came out and said, hey, I was pushing was this further. And again, this is proving that, like, he was aware of what he was doing. He was doing this because right. he knew he was in a prison experiment, not because
get away with it. Like,
yeah, because he knew it was an experiment, not because he thought it was an actual prison.
That is, like, so scary, though, because think of, like, all the experiments that have been conducted in the name of science that are probably worse than this.
There definitely probably are some. And that's why today there are so many requirements and that mm-hmm. things need to be properly recreated. The same results need to come until right. or before you make a proper conclusion.
Yeah.
But Eshelman was nicknamed John Wayne by his fellow guards for his Southern accent and his use of extreme cruelty, because he was the most brutal of the guards and he became a natural leader among them. After Zimbardo came out with these comments, after Eshelman came out with these comments, Zimbardo claimed that his actions went beyond the role of acting and that he and the other guards in the experiment showed signs of actually conforming to their roles. So he basically claims, like, this couldn't have just been acting. That was his response to Eshelman. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure he was enjoying that to some degree.
Yeah.
For sure.
Whew. And then there is the question of demand characteristics. So from the American Psychological Association, demand characteristics in an experiment or research project are cues that may influence or bias participants' behavior. This is essentially saying that if a participant is aware of what a researcher is trying to investigate or anticipates finding from an experiment, they will act mm-hmm. differently to sway the results, even if they don't realize it.
Yep.
So this is kind of what I was just saying, where it's like, you know, yes, the situation might have influenced them, but the situation wasn't that it was a prison. It was that it was an experiment.
Yeah. They were controlling a lot of things that maybe shouldn't have been controlled and maybe should have been controlling more things that weren't controlled.
Yeah. And then just in general, by knowing that you're coming into a prison experiment, of course the prisoners are going to act more like prisoners and the guards yeah. are going to act more like guards.
Yeah.
In 1975, two psychologists argued that the behavior of the participants in the SPE was a result of demand characteristics and not the prison environment, that there is no single definition of prisoner behavior, and that participants were simply acting in the role in which they had been cast. Then in 2012, Peter Gray, who is a psychologist, researcher, and scholar, and who has written many psychology textbooks that are used in courses all over the country, criticized the SPE for, again, demand characteristics. He said that the participants were influenced by the behavior of the researchers and that they acted out their stereotyped views of what prisoners mm-hmm. and guards do.
Yep. There it
so is. Again, it's not saying that Zimbardo's conclusions are wrong. It's just that this is
influenced.
They were influenced, and so you can't say that it's just the situation, because the situation is an experiment and demand characteristics played a part in that.
Yeah.
So Gray has written several psychology textbooks, but does not include Zimbardo's experiment in any of them. And in an article he wrote for Psychology Today, he sums up why this experiment is flawed. He says, quote, "In this game, what are these young men supposed to do? Are they supposed to sit around and talk pleasantly with one another about sports, girlfriends, movies, and such? No, of course not. This is a study of prisoners and guards, so their job clearly is to act like prisoners and guards, or, more accurately, to act out their stereotyped views of what prisoners and guards do." Hmm. He also went on to say, what would have happened if Zimbardo had said to the guards at the outset that the purpose of the experiment was to prove that it is possible to be both a guard and a decent human being, or in some way implied that the goal was to prove that guards could be kind. I bet the results would have been entirely different. The situation would have been the same, but the demand would have been different and the results would have been different.
Yeah, completely different.
So I just think, in my opinion, that sums it up perfectly, because, you know, it's not saying that he, like, it's just the nature of the experiment that it wasn't going to work.
Yeah. He wasn't entirely wrong, but everything he did was just influenced so heavily. So
exactly.
You're not coming to a good conclusion that can actually be
like, used.
Yeah, exactly.
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 Exactly. Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
There have been other researchers who have criticized all of this. One is German-American psychologist Eric Fromm, who argued that the SPE is not an example of good people turning evil, but rather is an example of how a situation cannot influence a person's behavior. In 2018, French researcher, and I am going to butcher this, I tried to look up how to say his name, and I just can't. Thibault Le Texier, something like that. I'm sure it's so wrong. But he wrote a book called The History of a Lie, which, again, I'm not going to try to pronounce the French version of it. But he believes that the submission of the prisoners and the sadistic and abusive behavior of the guards in the SPE was directly caused by Zimbardo's instructions. Mm-hmm. It should be noted that his American Psychology Association article published in 2019 has also been criticized by Zimbardo and others for focusing solely on attacks at the result and ignoring available data that contradicts his counterarguments. Finally, there are concerns about the ethicality of this experiment. The behavior of the guards was dangerous, and while no serious physical harm was caused, it could have been. And on top of that, the potential psychological damage is immeasurable. One of the biggest ethical concerns was that even when participants expressed their desire to withdraw from the experiment continued on. Now, they were told at the start that they had the right to leave at any time, but once the experiment actually started, they weren't allowed to leave.
Really. Yeah, under extreme circumstances, it seems.
Yeah, and it was later said that in the contracts, there was a very specific phrase that they had to say to get out of the experiment. And it was, I didn't write it down and I can't remember exactly what it was, but nobody said that actual phrase. So that's kind of why they didn't let them go and got past that like ethical contract.
They don't really want to go.
Yeah. So
like, okay.
Now, it is worth noting that this experiment took place in 1971, and since then, the guidelines for ethics in experiments involving human subjects have become significantly stricter.
Yeah.
And this experiment itself led to new ethical guidelines to be established. And this includes that human studies must now be reviewed by a board and found to be in accordance with ethical guidelines before they can take place.
Well, that's great. I'm glad that came from that, at least.
Yeah. Philip Zimbardo has stood strong in his belief that in his study and its results. He has participated in several court cases to discuss the use of force in prisons. This includes assisting the defense in the Abu Ghraib Iraqi prison abuse case. So in March 2004, information about prisoner torture and abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq was publicized. And when Zimbardo heard about what happened, he was intrigued by the similarities between what was happening and his own experiment. So he said he was disappointed that, quote, official military and government representatives shifted the blame for the torture and abuses in this American military prison onto a few bad apples rather than acknowledging the possibly systemic problems of a formally established military incarceration system. So he's basically saying, hey, they said that it's just a few bad apples and that's why this abuse is going on, but could it really be the environment? Which is a fair conclusion.
Yeah.
But again, you can't, his experiment can't be like used to prove that. Which
it's like apples and oranges. You're comparing this highly controlled experiment with like real life traumatic war events.
Exactly.
So not comparable. Sorry, bruh.
Yeah. But he did go on to help the defense team representing one of the prison guards, testifying as an expert witness to share the results of his study and claim that it isn't just people, it's their environment. I don't know what this says about him and his ability as an expert witness, but the guard was sentenced to 8 years in prison.
Oh, that's probably, I mean, that's probably for the best, because if he was doing abusive things, I mean, no matter what your circumstances are, even if you are in a war prison, like, you shouldn't go that far.
And that is exactly the issue with this experiment, is that, yes, it might be the system and the situation that you're in, but also the individual. And we've said this a million times with so many cases, but it's like nature and nurture.
Nature and nurture.
Both play a role. Yep. And that's what the issue a lot of people have with this experiment is that the findings might be accurate, but they're not the only thing that causes people to have these behaviors.
It's not mutually exclusive. Two things can be truth.
Exactly. Today, Philip Zimbardo is 91 years old, and he still stands by his study.
Look at him, 91. Wow. He was
still kicking.
Yeah.
In my opinion, the biggest takeaway here is that we can't make a conclusion based on the Stanford Prison Experiment. It's an interesting study. There's a lot of interesting discussion about it, and maybe some of the results and the findings are valid, but there's also a lot of other factors that can play into it.
Yeah.
But that, my friends, is the Stanford Prison Experiment. And I hope that I didn't go like too far into some of this stuff, because I tried to stay like somewhat high level while still covering all aspects of this. I definitely have like varying opinions about what came of this, but I definitely kind of think what I just said, that there's two sides to every story, kind of.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that was like missing or not done properly. And the fact that it can't be recreated just shows you that these findings should not be used to make conclusions about actual prison environments.
Yeah. And I also think to say that 100% of people put in X situation, Y could happen, I think that that's very naive, I guess. Not really naive, but just...
No, it's not...
It's not... I don't even know. Like, not... No one... Everyone... I just... No. It just...
You can't say that's
too much. Yeah. There's always going to be that 1% or whatever.
Exactly. Not all good people will turn evil if put in the right situation. I think I said that close to the beginning of the episode.
But I do think most.
I stand by that.
I do think most, though. I think that's just in us innately, most of us.
Yeah, it definitely can happen. But, you know, Zimbardo's experiment, unfortunately, was biased by demand characteristics, by selection bias, you know, people applying for this, having kind of being predisposed to some of those behaviors. Like, there's a lot that went into this. So I don't think that we can make just one conclusion from this. But
no,
I know this was a bit of a different episode.
That was really good.
I hope you guys enjoyed it. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts. So I'll post on Instagram and Facebook, but I'd love to hear what you guys think about the experiment of this episode, anything. But that is all I've got for you guys today. Thank you so much for listening, for being here. And until next time, keep it human.
Bye, guys.